Ladies and gentlemen, good morning and welcome to the Q3 and nine months FY 2021 earnings conference call of Home First Finance Company India Limited. This conference call may contain forward-looking statements about the company, which are based on the beliefs, opinions, and expectations of the company as on date of this call. These statements are not the guarantees of future performance and involves risk and uncertainties that are difficult to predict. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Manoj Viswanathan, Managing Director and CEO of Home First Finance Company India Limited. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. On behalf of the company, I extend a warm welcome to all of you. Thank you for joining us on the call today. Today on the call, I'm joined by Nutan, our CFO, other members of our team, and members of the team of Orient Capital, our investor relations partners. We have uploaded our investor deck and results highlights on the stock exchanges and the company website. I hope everybody had an opportunity to go through the same. I would like to thank you all for supporting us in the IPO and making it a grand success. Since this is our first call after the listing, I would like to share a brief overview on Home First, its journey so far, and growth strategies going forward. This would be followed by the operational and financial performance for the quarter and nine months ended FY 2021, post which we will open the floor for questions and answers. Home First is a leading player in the highly attractive affordable home finance sector. We cater to first-time home buyers in the lower and middle-income groups. We mainly offer housing loans for the purchase or construction of homes. Home First has deep penetration in the largest housing finance markets with a network of 72 branches across 60 districts in 11 states, with a significant presence in the urbanized regions in the states of Gujarat, Maharashtra, Karnataka, and Tamil Nadu. We have diversified lead-generating channels with a wide network of connectors. We have 47,440 live customers as of December 31st, 2020, which is 18% higher on a year-on-year basis. We differentiate ourselves as a home finance company with a superior technological edge across the value chain, right from origination to disbursements to collections. Our technology-led operating model helps us in delivering industry-leading productivity ratios and a turnaround time of 48 hours against industry average of 8-10 working days. We have centralized data science-backed underwriting model with a fully integrated CRM and a loan management system. Coming to key operational metrics of the company, for the first nine months of the year, we have 75% of the customers were salaried and 25% of them were self-employed. We have a very strong focus on home loans, and it constitutes 92% of the loan book. The average ticket size is 10.1 lakhs. On the liability side, the liquidity pipeline is very strong with positive ALM. We have relationship with 17 banks, and it's a good mix of institutions like public sector banks, private sector banks, and the National Housing Bank. We are rated by ICRA and CARE and have a long-term rating of A+ with a stable outlook. Moving to the results of quarter three FY 2021, we are pleased to report a good quarter. To start with, we have put COVID behind us with all branches as well as head office working in full strength from the office premises. We are also pleased to announce that the company was certified as a Great Place to Work by the GPTW Institute in this quarter, which is testimony to the unique and strong culture that our business leaders have nurtured. Some of the key highlights. On the AUM, the asset under management for 31st December 2020 stood at 39,406 million as against rupees 33,939 million for 31st December 2019. That is a growth of 16.1% on a year-on-year basis. We stayed focused on housing loans, with the housing loans forming 92% of the AUM, and 32% of the AUM is towards customers who are new to credit. We have opened six new branches in the last nine months, and our branch count is 72 as of December 20. Coming to disbursements. Disbursements for the nine months FY 2021 stood at 6,448 million as against 12,717 million, which is down by 49%, largely on account of COVID-19 pandemic, which had severe impact with the company's operations at the start of the financial year 2021. Our December 20 disbursements, however, are ahead of December 19. And our Jan 21 disbursements are ahead of December as well as last January, thereby marking the end of the decline. On collection efficiency, it has been on an upward trend, improving month on month, and has remained above 96% since September 20. It was 96.3% in October, 96.6% in November, and 97.6% in December 20. Our collection efficiency further improved to 97.8% in January. Coming to the asset quality, our gross stage 3 as a percentage of the principal outstanding stood at 1.6% on 31st December 2020, and net stage 3 was at 1.1%. We have done zero restructuring. I would now like to hand over the call to Nutan to take you through the financial metrics. Nutan, over to you.
Good morning. I'll quickly take you through the rest of the performance of Q3 FY21 and 9-month FY21 performance. On borrowings, total borrowings including debt securities are at 29,393 million as of December 2020 from 22,050 million as of December 19. We have healthy borrowings mix with 47% of our borrowings from banks, both public and private sector banks, 26% from NHB refinance and 20% from assignment. We have zero borrowings through commercial paper and our cost of borrowing has been trending downwards. Our quarter 3 FY21 cost of borrowing stood at 8%. During 9 months FY21, our assignment amount stands at 1844 million. We have used the assignment judiciously in line with our liquidity planning and we have not done any assignment or securitization transaction in the last two quarters. We will continue to explore these transactions which will help optimize the capital usage, bring down leverage and improve cost of funds as well as balancing the existing liquidity position. Our liquidity buffer as of December 20 was at 15,427 million. We recently raised 2,650 million through IPO, which will be utilized for increasing companies' Tier 1 capital. Our CRAR as of December was at 51% on the Tier 1 line. Our net worth as of December was 10,921 million. Moving to margins, our company has been operating at healthy and consistent spreads of over 4.5% over the past few quarters now. Our spread for Q3 FY21 is at 5%. Spreads have improved by 60 basis points on a year-on-year basis. The OPEX has seen a downward trend due to better and higher utilization of manpower and business from each branch and increasing operating efficiencies. We will further leverage our technology and strong internal processes to support growth and improve operating efficiencies. These will lead to profitable growth and drive returns. The productivity metrics continue to improve both on disbursement per branch and disbursement per employee basis. On provisions, ECL provision as of December 2020 is at 461.8 million, resulting in a total provision to loans outstanding ratio at 1.4%, and stage 3 provision coverage ratio is at 90.4%. On returns, our returns on average assets stood at 2.5% as of December 2020 and our ROE is at 9.1%. Our ROE has been lower on account of negative carry from higher cash balance maintained, 12% of total assets, and credit costs on account of COVID. We expect to continue to improve the returns going ahead with high growth on our disbursements and AUM and the operating leverage. On total income, our net interest income increased by 28% year-on-year to 1364 million for 9 months FY21. Our NIMs for 9 months FY21 stand at 4.9%. With this, I open the floor for Q&A.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may please press star then 1 on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star, then 2. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Anyone who wishes to ask questions, please press star, then 1. The first question is from the line of Karthik Chellappa from Buena Vista Fund Management. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity, team, and congrats on the IPO. I have three questions. The first one is the stage 3 loans, which stands currently at about 1.6%. In your assessment, at what point do you think that will peak? And what do you think will be the ultimate credit losses from this portfolio?
Yes, so hi Karthik, this is regarding the total gross stage 3 assets. So 1.6% is where we are now, and this also includes the portion that has kind of bloated up because of the Supreme Court order, where the cases cannot be declared as NP and hence we cannot repossess those properties. So we are expecting that Supreme Court order should get released probably in a couple of months, and then these numbers should start trending down. We are estimating that this number should stay at this kind of a level maybe for the next couple of quarters, and then based on when the Supreme Court order gets released, the numbers will start coming down. As far as the credit losses are concerned from this, so let us if we assume that the gross stage 3 will be at about, let's say, 1.622%. Typically, the loss given default in this group is about 20 to 30%. That would be the kind of losses that would come from this group. So 2% multiplied by about 20 to 30 basis points.
Okay, 20 to 30%. Okay, perfect. This is great. My second question is, what would be the incremental yield that you are earning on the portfolio that, let's say, you have originated in the third quarter, as well as probably even in January? A rough idea.
Karthik, you are talking about spreads, I presume.
Not spreads, just the incremental portfolio yield based on the lending rate.
So our portfolio yield on disbursements are at 13% for quarter three.
Okay, so that means the incremental portfolio yield that you are earning is more or less equal to the weighted average yield on the portfolio. Is
correct?
Can I understand it that way?
Yes. So is the product mix.
Okay, so is the product mix. Okay, and the last question is on the LTV vintage that you have given by ticket size. If I were to just split it into two, which is below 1.5 million and above 1.5 million, what would roughly the difference in the yields be?
Difference in the yield or difference in the LTV?
No, different in the yield. So let's say if it's a 20 lakh loan or a 25 lakh loan as opposed to, let's say, a 10 lakh loan, what would the difference in the yield roughly be?
So the yields generally are in the region of 12 to 14%. It would be more dependent upon the profile of the customer, whether he's coming from a formal background or a self-employed background, and less linked to ticket size. I would say, it would range between 12 to 14% across all ticket sizes. And the yield would be more closely linked to whether the customer is coming from a formal salaried or an informal salaried or a self-employed background, because that is how the yield is, or the interest rates are pegged.
Okay, got it. Just one follow-up, the last one, and then I'll fall back into the queue. If you look at the securitization income, it's actually been quite volatile over the periods, because in the December quarter last year, there was a bulk of 160 million which we booked. But for the last two quarters, we have not booked any securitization income. On a steady state basis, what percentage of your funding would you expect to come from direct assignment stroke securitization? That will be all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Karthik. So far, we have been maintaining a healthy ratio of around 15 to 20%. Firstly, securitization is going and is a big liquidity measure for us. When we are planning for next year, we are expecting securitization to be in the range of around 20 to 25%. So we expect that this will become more consistent quarter on quarter going forward.
Okay, this is great. Thank you very much, team. Wish you all the best. I'll come back in the queue for more questions, if any. Thank you.
Perfect.
Thank you. Participants who would like to ask questions, please press star, then one. The next question is from the line of Chetan Ginodia from Alpha Carrot Advisors. Please go ahead.
Hello, sir. My question is, what would be our incremental cost of borrowing?
Our incremental cost of borrowing for quarter three is 5.8%. It includes a substantial NHB proportion.
Okay. Okay. And okay. And we have seen a sharp increase in our plus one DPD and plus 30 DPD. So, what would be the reason for this, and how do we when do we expect this to settle?
Yes, so the delinquencies have increased in keeping with the whole COVID pandemic. So we had a number of customers who took their moratoriums, and the moratorium ended in August. So from September, these customers had to start repaying. So some of them, you know, maybe about 1 to 2% of the entire base are having some struggle in repaying the installments, which is why the 1 DPD as well as 30 DPD have moved up. To some extent, this is also contributed because of the embargo on, you know, declaring cases as NPA, so which, you know, so as a result of which we are not able to impose the SARFAESI and repossess these properties. So that, you know, as a result of which the stage 3 keeps increasing. So what we are thinking is that we are, at the moment, our, you know, the rate, which is the most leading indicator of, you know, how the portfolio is behaving. That has been continuously declining. So if you look at our bounce rates, it has gone down to about 20% in C, and even in January, the bounce rates have come down further. So looking at the trend of bounce rates, we think that the delinquency trend will continue at this current level for maybe another 2 to 3 quarters, post which we can expect it to kind of come back to the pre-COVID levels.
Okay, okay. And what would be our ROE aspirations for the next 2-3 years? And that would be my last question.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
What is our ROE aspiration on a medium-term basis? What ROE would be like to reach?
So if you look at, you know, the way our ROEs have been trending, I mean, so we have been at about 10% ROE for the last couple of years. And this also has factored in the, you know, extra cash that we are carrying since, you know, the ILFS days. So which, you know, contributes around another 2% in a sense. You know, the ROE drag of about 2% because of the cash that we are carrying. So we are on a continuous path in terms of, you know, reducing our cost to income, improving our spreads and, you know, efficiencies. So you will, you know, see a kind of secular improvement in the, you know, ROEs going forward.
Okay, okay. I'll come back in the queue. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Nidhesh Jain from Investec. Please go ahead.
Thanks for the opportunity, sir. So firstly, on the securitization, when we do securitization, it is under direct assignment route or on a PTC route?
It is on direct assignment route.
And can you just explain the accounting treatment of the transaction? What percentage of, if we are securitizing 100 rupees of loan, how much of income is recognized in that particular quarter?
So the accounting basically works that, so for example, on a 100 rupee loan, if my book is at 13% and am I securitizing at 8%, so the spread difference of 5% over the balance tenor of the pool of loans, we do need to do an NPV and take as income in the month of securitization itself. The spread and the discussion and the sanction from the bank at what rate they are buying the pool.
Sure. So is there any ballpark number that if I assigning 100 rupees, how much of the income will be recognized? 10 rupees, 20 rupees? Or?
I can share the, just give me 1 minute. So we did the assignment of around 357 crores last year, and we booked 37 crores of income. This year we have done to date 184 crores of assignment, and we have booked 25 crores of income. The reason for this expansion is because the spreads have expanded as a result of MCLR reduction and our improvement in quality of the pools. So this helps you forming a trend.
Okay. Sure. Is there any impact on our P&L of assignment this quarter, or there is no impact?
We have not done any assignment in quarter two or quarter three.
Okay. Thank you. That's it from my side.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Susmit Patodia from Motilal Oswal Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, team, and congratulations. My first question is, if you can just take us through, in a normal business case scenario, if you have a 10% check bounce rate, what does that finally translate to in terms of your collection mechanism? Because what I'm trying to get at is that today we have a 20% check bounce rate and at least 4% DPD 30 plus. Versus 1.6% GS3, but really the trend is more like 10 to 1. So are we underestimating GS3 right now?
So let me take you through the pre-COVID ratios. So 10% used to be the bounce rate, which roughly used to translate into 1.5 to 2% of 30 days past due, which would further translate into a NPA of about anywhere between 70 basis points, 7 to about 1%. So that used to be the waterfall pre-COVID. So what we are seeing now is kind of a doubling of that, which is 10% has gone to 20%, and on similar lines, the 30 days past due has moved to close to 4%. And the, stage 3 or the pro forma NPA has moved to about 1.6%. So which is why we are saying that, if you look at the pre-COVID ratios, if let's say roughly 50% of the 30 plus moves to NPA, so on similar lines we are looking at between say 1.5 to 2% as the NPA in the current scenario.
And the other thing was you mentioned that you will securitize 20 to 25%, but with so much capital and so much liquidity, shouldn't that be pulled down for the next couple of years? Any thoughts on that?
Can you repeat your question? We were not able to hear you well.
Yeah, no, I'm saying that with so much capital and so much liquidity,
right?
Does it still make sense to securitize the same proportion that you've been doing at least for the next 2-3 years, or would it make sense to use the capital and run down the liquidity?
So we will have to be judicious on all lines. Securitization per se works very well from an ALM point of view because it is linked directly on the back-to-back asset. It helps build credibility with banks and lending institutions as they review our book and form an opinion on our book on a more detailed basis, because securitization goes through a fairly detailed level of audit. And when that happens, and and currently liquidity that we are carrying of around 1500 crores, we will need to raise further liquidity for our next year plans. So it will have to go hand in hand.
You will need further liquidity next year,
right?
Beyond what you have and the capital.
We will need cash flow definitely.
And my the next question is, you have this LTV of origination which says 44% 80 plus,
right?
And effective LTV on book drops to 18% of this number, but your book is not seasoned that much. So I'm just trying to understand, how are you able to finance, because the repayment won't be to that extent, right? So effectively, property price has to go up, and that has not gone up in the last 3 years in India.
No, these LTVs are, we are not really pegging it on the, I can say revised property prices. These are on the original property prices. The reduction in LTV is because of prepayments. If you look at it in our segment, typically the while the contractual tenure is around 17 to 20 years, the effective tenure is in the region of around 6 to 7 years. So there are, a lot of prepayments that come in from customers from their own funds. So that is one reason. Secondly, there is also the credit link subsidy scheme, which is provided by the Pradhan Mantri Awas Yojana. So that reduces the loan amount by about 20% in the first year itself. So there's about 20% of the loan amount that is prepaid, as part of the credit link subsidy scheme. So that reduces the LTV by about 20%. So these are the two contributors as to and the reason reason for this reduction in the LTVs.
So just my last question.
Mr. Patodia, may we request you to come back in the queue for a follow-up, please?
Yes, sir.
Sure. Thank you. The next question is from the line of Gurpreet Arora from Aviva Life India. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for the opportunity. Just one question. What sort of cost ratios, OPEX ratios are we looking to achieve going ahead on a sustainable basis?
So if you look at it, our OPEX to AUM is around 3.5%, which is fairly good given our scale. We continue to work on our operating leverage by improving efficiency across branches, across our operations in head office. And we are confident that the ratios will continue to improve over the medium term.
Any specific number you're targeting?
Yeah, so if you look at our own branches, if you look at our new branches versus the branches which are a little larger or mature branches, so the larger branches are typically in the region of 2 to 2.5% of X to AUM. So you can say that, that's the kind of number that we are, we have as a pro forma for all the branches.
Got it. That's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Participants who would like to ask questions, please press star, then one. The next question is from the line of Jaspreet Singh Arora from Equindus PMS. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the opportunity. Just a clarification. So our net worth post the IPO and fresh issue, would it be ballpark 1200 crores now?
Our net worth post the IPO is 1092 is our December net worth and 255 is the capital that we raised through IPO. So that's around
1350 crores. 1350 crores.
Okay, 1350.
Yeah.
This is post December and including IPO proceeds.
Right.
Okay, great. And what sort of loan book growth? A range would suffice. What can we expect in the next couple of quarters? What's your comfort zone?
So if you see our AUM growth in the first 9 months of this year has been 16% on a year-on-year basis, and this is considering the fact that we had almost nil disbursal in the first quarter, and the disbursal in the second quarter was also fairly low. So if you kind of add that back, 16%, will move up by a certain number. If you our current quarter, that is the October, November, December quarter numbers, if you kind of extrapolate, that can give you an indication of the kind of growth that we are expecting.
Okay. So the reason I'm asking is this because of the current industry tailwinds and the way some of the larger guys, the larger peers are growing, which is in, low to mid double digit. Shouldn't we be on a slightly higher terrain, at least in, maybe the 20 to 30% zone? Just was kind of, and also given the fact that we're looking at our average ticket sizes is like 10 lakhs. So was curious why we are not in that, given we also have liquidity to support us.
Right. So if you look at our growth last year, that was in the region of about 40%, right? That is FY20 over FY19. So this year, the first, as I mentioned, the first two quarters, the disbursals were quite low because of the pandemic. So we will have to look at the growth rate as a, as a function of, what we have disbursed in the third quarter, and using that as a run rate, we can extrapolate what the growth rate would be. So it would not be very different from the kind of numbers which you are talking about.
Okay. And just lastly, the new to credit segment, I believe that's about 40% in our case. I'm just trying to...
That's right. On the book it is about 32%, and on our customers basis it's around 40%.
And the sourcing mix between direct and indirect is like equally split. Is that how it's for us?
Indirect and direct as in channels you are talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, it's about 50-50. 50% is sourced by our own in-house efforts and about 50% comes from connector channel.
Connect. So in both these areas, are you comfortable with this, both the sourcing mix as well as the new to credit or do you want to, you know, is there a better number you think could be there a year down the line? What's your...
Yeah, as far as the new to credit is concerned, that's a function of, you know, population itself. So if you see when we started business 10 years ago, the new to credit used to be around 70%, and only about 30% of the customers had a credit bureau history. But over time, you know, since credit has become more easily available to customers, more and more customers tend to have a consumer durable loan or a two-wheeler loan, you know, before they come in for a home loan. So that number is, the new to credit number is constantly decreasing, and so we are seeing that decreasing on a quarter on quarter basis. So that is more of a function of, you know, how the population is behaving. So we expect it to be in this region for maybe a couple of quarters and then keep decreasing. So maybe after 2 or 3 years there will be very little new to credit, in a sense, even in affordable housing. That's how we are seeing it. As far as the second question is...
connectors and direct, yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah, the connectors and direct route, yeah.
Yeah, so as far as the channel channel split is concerned, we are fairly comfortable with this. And, these are, as the company grows, both of these in-house as well as the connector channels will, we will focus on growing both of them simultaneously.
Okay, great. Yeah, thanks for answering all the questions and all the best.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Apoorva Trivedi from Moon Capital. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the opportunity. I was just looking at page 28 of your presentation. The non-interest income line item has been down quarter on quarter. Could you just explain what are the sources? You know, this is excluding BA, I think. Given that disbursement had increased, I would have expected this to do well. I just wanted to understand what's driving this.
Hi, Apoorva. Good morning. So you're right. The non-interest income has its composition of multiple items. So first, there are two items that are going up. So what is going up is the interest on bank deposits from the fact that we are maintaining better liquidity. The second item that is going up is other interest income which we earn through our liquid funds. So that's essentially again coming from the treasury route. What is going down is a one-off income that we had booked last year through some displays and advertisements that we had done in our branches, across our 60 branches. So there we had booked around 6 crores, which we have not been able to book this time because post-COVID those contracts have not continued simply because there's the lack of footfalls in the branches. So that is one line that has gone out. We are not expecting this line, Apoorva, to come back anytime soon, given, not everyone is looking at customers coming to branches and looking at advertisements from other products. So that is the difference. You're right, the assignment income has not happened, which was a larger chunk of 16 crores. Like I mentioned, assignment is something we would like to continue doing more consistently quarter on quarter, so that... will nullify in our minds.
Okay, so the non-interest income, the 9 crores that is there, it does not include the kind of origination fees, etc., that you could charge customers. Is that correct?
Yeah, the origination fee is amortized in Ind AS, so it goes and gets added into the interest income line on an amortized basis.
Okay, understand. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Apoorva.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Abhijit Tibrewal from Reliance Securities. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Congratulations, Manoj and Nathan. So I was just trying to understand the competitive landscape right now. Can you help me understand what was the balance transfers like in the last quarter? And how does it compare with Q3 of FY20?
Yeah, so balance transfers, have been declining gradually over the last 3-4 years. And, so last year, I think same time we were at about, on an annualized basis, we were at around 4% was the, balance transfers. So which is coming down to around, If you look at it, last quarter was around 1.7 or 2% was the balance transfer. So it is declining gradually. So against the 4%, I think we would be at around 2% this year.
Okay. And one of the follow-up question on that, and that will be my last question. So I was a little curious in terms of how are we able to maintain a portfolio and incremental yields of about 13%, given that, I mean, the cost of borrowings have come down so much, our affordable housing peers, the larger banks are so aggressive. And despite that, if you're able to maintain incremental yields of about 13%, I mean, does it suggest that, I mean, these are customers who would probably not get a housing loan from anyone else, and which is why, I mean, we lend to them and that's how we are able to maintain our yield at these levels?
So Abhijit, you know, see, we have always, you know, if you look at the last few years, we have always been maintaining a similar kind of yields. We have been operating on the same, on a similar competitive landscape. So there are certain USPs that we bring to the table. We are quicker in terms of turning around the loan for the customer. We do a more holistic assessment of the customer's family income. So we spend time with the customer to understand, you know, what other sources of income they have, how many family members are working and so on. So in the affordable housing space, you know, this is the kind of validation that we are bringing to the table. And customers are willing to pay that little premium, you know, for that service that we are providing. So speed is very critical for them. This holistic assessment and providing the right loan amount is very critical for the customers. So they are willing to pay that little extra, you know, to get that additional service. So which is why we are able to operate at this kind of, you know, these kind of rates. And I hope that answers your question.
Yes, Anand. Sir, my last question to you. I mean, has the repricing of the book happened, or is it still ongoing now?
Repricing, as in,
I mean, given that, I mean, interest rates have come down, customers kind of start approaching you and kind of check with you if their interest rates can be reduced. Given that, let's say, some other peer would be offering a lower interest rate now. I'm talking about the existing customers that you have.
Yeah, so as you can see, our balance transfers are not, you know, not very high. I mean, they're in fact declining on a quarter-on-quarter basis. There has been no trigger from in that sense to from a customer retention perspective. So that is one. Secondly, wherever we are getting a benefit of rate, for example, when we draw down funds from National Housing Bank at a lower rate, we pass on that benefit to the customer. So we have actually passed on, I think, benefit to about 2,000 to 3,000 customers in the last quarter, and probably we will pass on the benefit to another 2,000 to 3,000 customers in the current quarter as well. So as we are drawing down funds at lower rates, we are passing on the same benefit to the to the customers as well.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, and that's very helpful. Wish you and the team the very best.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Bhavik Dave from Nippon India Mutual Fund. Please go ahead. Bhavik Dave from Nippon India, please unmute your line from your side.
Hello, am I audible?
Yes.
Hi, sir. I only one question. I just wanted to understand what is your average age of customers, like on an incremental basis and on the book, if you have this data available.
Yeah, so age of customers, the average age is around 35 to 37 years. But we have the entire gamut from, say, 20 years till, 50 years in our customer base. So there is, but the average, if you say, would be around. And the larger population is typically between, say, 30 to 50 years.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Deepak Mittal from Edelweiss. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. So this is actually a follow-up on Apu's question on non-interest income, which Nikun answered to some extent. So if you look at this non-interest income, it was also about 12 crore in quarter 2 FY21 versus 9 crore in quarter 3 FY21. So this advertising contract, which is no longer there, which I think was affected in quarter 3 FY20. Was advertising contract continued till quarter 2 FY21 and then got finished, or So I understand why there was a decline, but I'm not sure if I understood quarter and quarter why there was a decline from 12 crore to 9 crore in non-interest income.
So Deepak, no, the contracts ended in March, right at the time when COVID happened, so we were not able to continue. The 12 crores in September that you see is a totally different composition. So because it's non-interest income, the composition keeps changing every time. So in 12 crores that you see for H1 FY21 is a mix of again some large amounts of treasury income that we earned during that period, as well as some other income that came from, because when we pass on some subsidies or when we get subsidy approvals, we also get some income from NHB. So all of that comes and sits here. So we are not, effectively looking at this income being the main line of income. What we're looking at, the main line of income is the interest income, which you see has improved both on a quarter-on-quarter basis as well as a year-on-year basis. So that's a real focus.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Vivek Gautam from GS Investments. Please go ahead.
Yes, sir. My question is, if we compare our number to that of your rivals, like Aavas, because Aavas was the criteria decided by you while going in for higher pricing of price to book value, there the growth is much better, 37% and PAT is 26%, offline is 30%. And provisioning figure is also much better. And why our growth has sort of been tepid in that regard, and when can we expect it back to go to that particular level?
So, as we mentioned, the first two quarters of this year, we were fairly focused on, fairly focused on collections and wanted to make sure that, we are taking all the right steps to, protect the portfolio. So some of the growth plans, etc., we started rolling out, in the third quarter. So you will probably see the impact of that in the coming quarters. And in spite of all of this, we have still grown by 16% on a year-on-year basis. So it has been, we have basically been prudent in the first two quarters to, make sure that we are focusing more on collections to get things under control before we really, you can say, step out into the market and, start building, start working on the growth aspect. So I think, most of the initiatives that we have taken in terms of rolling out new locations, new launches, etc., have happened in the third quarter. And so you will see the impact of that coming in the next few quarters.
Is all the stress accounted for in the books, or still some is left?
So if you see the overall provisioning that we have created, it is substantially higher than what we normally do. So typically our provision on the book is around 60 basis points, whereas as you can see now we are sitting at about 1.4% of the book as provisions. Similarly, the coverage ratio is, typically in the region of about 50-60%, which is now gone up to almost 90%. So you can say that, yes, we are sufficiently, rather prudently provided for, whatever stress that we are anticipating. To some extent, the stress is also because of, our inability to, repossess and foreclose the properties. Which I think once the Supreme Court order gets released, we should be able to start doing.
And our capital adequacy ratio is very high and leading to very low return on equity of 9%. And we have given beautiful exits to our private equity, Top North and everyone at 4 times. And then even to this Warburg Pincus, they got in very cheap at 334 rupees and there. And public has got it at 518. So what was the need for such a high capital adequacy and money infusion by Warburg Pincus also? And because as you see that the performance of the expectation as per the expectation, the performance slightly on the lower side.
If I may clarify, so True North is a promoter. They have a lock-in for 3 years as part of the SEBI guidelines, and Warburg Pincus has just come in October and they also have a lock-in for 1 year. As far as specific performance is concerned, yes, the ROE is at 9%. Our prior ROE has been in the range of 10-10.1%. Specifically for this year, given that there is COVID, there are two specific aspects. The first aspect is the negative carry in the cash that the entire industry and we have had to carry. That has subdued the ROE by almost 2%. The second is around the COVID provisions that we've taken, like Manoj mentioned, from 0.6% to almost 1.4%. So that's a significant, ROE drag that we've had to take. With things settling down and with growth looking improving, like we've discussed, ROE is something we are keenly focused on. Growth along with focus on operating and improving leverage are the three things where we believe we should be able to improve ROE on a quarter-on-quarter basis going forward.
Madam, thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Kaushik Agarwal from Haitong Securities. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Good morning and thank you for the opportunity. Am I audible?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yeah, so I just have two questions. First is on regarding your stage 2 asset. So seeing slide number 26 on the PPT, comparing March 20 numbers and December 20, the stage 2 assets have spiked during this quarter. So wanted to understand what kind of customer profile is basically in this stage 2 and what will be the likely slippages of the stage 2 into stage 3 in the coming quarters. And the second question is on the branch expansion strategy for the company. Wanted to understand like what is the likely target for the branch count for the company in the next year and which regions are the company focusing on. Yeah, these are the two questions.
Yeah, sure. So as far as the stage 2 is concerned, so this will typically, as you can see, our 30 days past due has moved from pre-COVID levels of about 1.5 to 2% to about 4% in the last couple of months. So that is where this stage 2 increase also is coming from. If you look at, the customer, and if I were to give you some granularity on the customers who are in this bucket, so these would be typically customers who would have taken a moratorium, during the moratorium period which ended in August, and, who would have defaulted, say, for example, in September or October. And after that, they are in a, stage of trying to catch up on their missed installments. So we are getting a lot of, compared to pre-COVID levels, we are getting a lot of customers who are paying one installment and remaining in the same bucket, in the last couple of months. And there are also customers where we are trying to, collect more than one installment and trying to roll them back. So the stage 1 and 2 would consist of these customers who, probably had some impact during COVID and, from September, September or October, they would have missed a couple of payments. And now they are, coming back on track. They are making payments regularly, but they are able to make only one payment a month. And hence, they are kind of stuck in stage 2. So that would be the, if I were to give you a granular feel of what kind of customers are in stage 2, that would be the profile of these customers. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, so just a follow-up question on this. Do we have any such customer who has taken moratorium as not paid a single installment till now, the moratorium customer?
Yeah, so that would that is included in this 1.6% which is there in the gross stage 3. So we have about, close to, 400 or 500 customers who would have also taken moratorium, but post the moratorium ending, they were not able to make any payments and hence they have now slipped into stage 3. So that is part of the 1.6% which is there in stage 3.
Okay, sir. Okay. Yeah, that's answered the question, sir. Second on the branch expansion strategy.
Yeah. So, we have always, believed that, the total number of branches is not, factor for growth. We are looking at actually building up the AUM or disbursal that each branch can do. So that is where our focus is. Having said that, we are looking at a number of locations which are contiguous to our existing locations. So we have currently identified about 20 such locations. We have started work in these locations. So typically our process is that we work on building the business in these locations before putting up a branch. So we have a kind of outreach program where a person works in the location for about 6 months, builds up a small portfolio, and then we put up the branch. So currently that process is underway in about 20 locations. As the portfolio builds up there to about 5 to 10 crores, we will put up a branch. So you can expect that branch rollout to happen after a certain lag. So this quarter we have actually rolled out operations in about 20 new locations.
Okay, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Rishabh Doshi from Pro Investment Invest Wealth Managers. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi Manoj. Congrats on a successful IPO listing. Just on the last point, I wanted to understand, like, you know, if we have decided to go in a particular location, then, you know, why do we wait to build a 10 crore book? Like, because, you know, having a branch in a new location, it gives confidence to the customer also. And my second question is that, you know, after FY, our major chunk of our books, around 60%, has been, you know, built after FY18. So could you just give us some qualitative data on how the delinquencies have been on the older book, the book which has been written below before FY18?
Yeah, sure. This is a process that we have followed for branch expansion or new location rollout, since several years, and it has paid us good dividends in terms of being able to identify all the issues and problems before we enter the location and put up a branch. So there have also been instances where after working there for a couple of months, we realized that the market is not conducive, and we should ideally not put up a branch in those locations. So it helps us identify those early problems at an earlier stage. So which is why we continue to follow that process. Plus, it also gives us an advantage from a cost perspective, because the moment the branch, physical branch comes up, we have sufficient portfolio to actually cover the cost. So we are kind of breaking even on, breaking even very quickly. So these are the two reasons. As far as the portfolio buildup is concerned, if you look at our lagged delinquency, that will give you an indication. Pre-COVID, our delinquency was around 0.8%, 0.9%. And if you look at our lagged delinquency, that is, if you take away the growth for the last 2 years, the lagged delinquency was in the region of around 2%. So that should, that will give you an indication of the, delinquency of the book prior to the, prior to that growth.
Yeah. And I just missed one point, I couldn't hear it properly. Regarding the direct assignment, this year, it was 184 crores, right? And the income was?
226 crores.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Avinash Tanavade from Dalal & Broacha. Please go ahead.
Hello, sir. Hello, sir. Am I audible?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you for the opportunity. My first question is about our attrition rate in our employee attrition. It is around 36% in FY19 and FY20. What are the steps we are taking to reduce that rate? Or what is the reason for such a higher attrition rate?
So if you see, employee attrition, typically, most of our employees are in frontline roles. And these are all people who are, who are largely freshers or, people with a very, say between 1 to 2 years of experience. If you compare with the industry, we fare, quite reasonable in terms of the attrition rate. So we are not very worried about the attrition rate. So at that entry level and at the, frontline sales level, you can see this kind of attrition. It's not something that worries us. If you look at the attrition, rather when we look at our attrition at a stage where the employee has already spent say 2 to 3 years with us, that number is very, very low. So which is why we are comfortable with the overall process.
Okay. And about our write-off policies, how much year or how much months later after tagging an NPA, we write off our accounts?
Basically look at it, from the recovery aspect itself, as per the Ind AS guidelines, right? So if our assessment of the loan is that, there is a very low possibility of recovery, then we, write it off. So it's not directly linked only to the vintage of the loan loan itself. It also depends upon what legal actions have been taken. What is the recovery estimate that we have? What is the property price? So multitude of factors, and we basically look at whether what is the possibility of recovery from the property. If the property possibility is very low, then we put it in the write-off category.
So historically, what kind of loan loss ratio we have seen, or what kind of recoveries we have seen in our NPA accounts?
So loss given default is in the region of around 18 to 20%. So if once a loan moves into into the NPA bucket, the loss given default is around 18 to 20%.
Even though we have a secure loan and LTV of lower than 80%, we have such a loss ratio of 18%.
So these are anyway this ratio is on a very low base. If you look at it, so this would be a total of maybe in historically say 200 or 300 accounts on which this calculation is being done. So to that extent, it is a in a sense it is a self-selected weak weak base on which this 20% is being arrived at. So 98% of the book or 99% of the book that logic holds good, that we are. Our LTV is low and the recovery is possible. But on a few accounts that go bad, there will obviously be some let's say challenge in selling the property or some reduction in price, etc., because of which that we incur that loss.
So how much time it usually takes to surface here to recover the money from NPA account?
So typically once a loan goes into NPA, it takes about 3 months to complete the surfacey process. After we repossess, it typically takes around maybe 2 to 3 months to sell. So you can say totally on an average bit of about 4 to 6 months from the time the loan goes into NPA.
So what is our incremental cost of borrowing?
Our increment for quarter 3 FY21 is 5.8%.
Okay. And how much is from if we have taken any loan from banks, what kind of incremental cost they are offering to us?
So the range is between 7.6% to 8.2%.
And out of our total borrowing, how much percentage fixed and how much is variable?
Fixed is a very small percentage. Just give me a minute. So fixed is around
21%. Okay. Earlier, may be requested to come back in the queue, please.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Karthik Chellapur from Buena Vista Fund Management. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity again, sir. Just two follow-ups. The 7.5% of one-day DPD, how will that get split between salaried and self-employed, and which would be the geographies above the 7.5%?
Yeah, so typically speaking, if you look at our overall ratio of the population, that is 75% is salaried and 25% is self-employed. But if you look at our delinquency buckets, typically the ratio tends to be 50-50. So 50% is salaried and 50% is self-employed. So typically that would be the breakup. As far as geographies are concerned, the geographies that got impacted by COVID more. So if you take, Bombay, Pune, the NCR region, Surat, for example. So these are, three or four markets where, the COVID impact was highest. As a result of which, you can say the one DPD is also higher in these places.
Got it. My last question is on the securitization, on the direct assignment income booking. Now, given that you actually take an NPV of the spread over the tenure of the loan and recognize it upfront, what happens when that loan becomes the subject matter of a BT out? Do you have to reverse it at some point of time in case it gets switched to another financial institution?
So see, Karthik, technically the loan is already sold. So it's not a BT out from our books. It is a BT out from the bank books. So we have to work very closely with the bank, helping them record each of these subsequent transactions. And that's the role that we operate as a servicer to these loans.
So hypothetically, I mean, if you were to direct assign it to another bank and then the borrower comes forward with a proposal from a bank B and wants to do a BT out, and assuming that does get balance transferred out, it is the bank to whom you have assigned it which loses the loan. So the income that you have booked upfront, does any portion of that need to be reversed because of this, or is it without any recourse to you?
It is absolutely without any recourse.
So the only loser would probably be the bank that bought the loan from you. It has to go leave their books basically because you will intimate them accordingly.
Right. The only caveat to this, Karthik, is that when we do assignment, we do not assign 100% of the loan. We assign 80% of the loan or 90% depending on the sanction of that point in time. So the balance 20% or the 10% is what we will lose, which is like any other BT out.
Like any other BT out. Okay, thank you for this clarification. That's all from my side. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Pooja Ahuja from Equintus Wealth. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Pooja. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just had two questions. So firstly, you had mentioned earlier that there are certain branches which have matured and have AUM about 150 crores. So out of the 72 branches, how many would have this kind of AUM?
So I will give you the exact number. It should be around 15 branches.
Okay. Okay. And currently your top three states are contributing 70% to AUM. Is there any particular target to lower this number? And what time?
Top three states.
We couldn't hear your question well. Can you repeat?
So, if the top three states are currently contributing 70% to the AUM, do we have any target to lower this, and in what time period?
The way we look at it is, see, these top three states which you are talking about would be Gujarat, Maharashtra, and Tamil Nadu.
Right.
They also happen to be the largest, housing as well as affordable housing markets in the country. So in a sense, you know, the percentage or the proportion that's coming from here is justified. So we are not really targeting at reducing that. However, we are also, focusing on certain states, for example, Karnataka, Andhra, Telangana, Rajasthan, etc. to increase our share and share of the business from coming from these states and our market share in these states. So there will be a kind of secular, reduction in, the contribution that's coming from the top three states, and while the other states go up slightly. That's the way we are looking at it.
Okay. All right, yeah, that's the mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the last question. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Manoj Vishwanathan for closing comments.
Thank you. So thank you everyone for joining us on this first call. I hope you have been able to answer all your queries. In case you require any further details, you can get in touch with us directly or with Orient Capital, our investor relations partners. And in summary, I just want to mention that our asset under management is continuously increasing, our spreads are continuously increasing, and our cost to income is decreasing. So all profit metrics are on an improving or increasing path. The direct assignment is a tool for liquidity and ALM management. And due to the Ind AS accounting guidelines, the income from the DA needs to be taken upfront. So depending upon whether the DA is taken is done in a particular month, carried out in a particular quarter or not, there will be some variation in the PAT for that quarter. So that is what I wanted to summarize. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Home First Finance Company India Limited, that concludes this conference. We thank you all for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.